do you think brings success in marriage? Compatibility? Love? Sex? Independence? Dependence? Hi, I'm Bill Wright. Today on the Mini Bible College, you're going to hear Dick Woodward say that marriage is a providential, permanent, exclusive, and an all-inclusive relationship. And you know the tool that makes it happen? Communication. Let's join him right now in a brand new message. The tool that maintains the oneness, communication.
We have said that communication is the tool that makes it possible for us to maintain the oneness that we have in this relationship that God has put together and brought together for us. The relationship of marriage, unlike the relationship between parent and child that's destined to part, this relationship should get closer and closer and closer and closer. Now, it may be that that depresses you because the first time Jenny and I heard this, it just upset her something awful because we were passing like shifts in the night and she was building a family in one world and I was building the kingdom in the other world and we weren't doing that. A man named James Hatch shared this and it was in the summertime. We invited him to come to our church that year. And by the time he came to the church, we were more open to it. We realized that this is supposed to be a relationship, as we've seen. It's a providential relationship. It's a permanent relationship. It's an exclusive relationship. It's an all-inclusive relationship. And we have to work at that relationship. Well, communication gives us the tools with which we can work on that relationship. This is a Webster Dictionary definition of communication. Communication is a giving and receiving of information, messages, and ideas by talk, gestures, or other means. Now, based upon that definition, here are some observations we can make. There are always two dimensions to communication, a giving dimension and a receiving dimension. That means there are always two dimensions to communication problems, the sender and the receiver. The problem could be with the sender, or the problem could be with the receiver. I heard about a woman who went to a marriage counselor, and she said she just had to get a divorce. There was nothing to it. It just had to be a divorce. And he asked her, well, let's talk about it. And in the course of the dialogue, the counselor asked her, do you have a grudge? She said, oh, no, man, we got a carport, you know. And he said, oh, I see, you know. So a little later on, he said, well, do you think you've got grounds? And she said, we got grounds, but we have 15 acres. And then he said, well, does he beat you up every morning? She said, no, I get up most mornings before he does. And finally, the counselor said, well, just what is your problem? She said, I just can't carry on a conversation with that man. Well, probably anybody would have trouble carrying on a conversation with her because the message was garbled. The sender, that could be where the problem is. Or the problem could be with the receiver, the way it's received, based upon this definition. Communication problems come in at least two sizes. One size is silence. There just isn't any communication, people say. And in the first 5 minutes of almost every counseling session, this is what is said. We haven't got any communication. And by that, they usually mean we don't talk. Now, silence does not always mean you have a communication problem, but it very often does. People are different. I'm a compulsive talker. I'm very uncomfortable with silence, especially if I'm entertaining a guest or something. I just can't let there be silence, and I'll just babble like an idiot to keep the conversation going. And I've always admired these deep, silent types that don't have a need to talk, because I just have to talk. I had a real good friend, still have a good friend, who's an orthodontist. He's the quietest man you'll ever meet in your life. And one day, on a trip with him, I was babbling like an idiot. And I said, you haven't got much to say, have you? He said, well, Dick, and he wasn't being, you know, he loved me. He was being nice. But he said, Dick, let me tell you something. You know, where the water is deep, it's still and silent. But where it's shallow, it babbles. You know? Well, you know, he's got a point there. You know, the water, we call it a babbling brook, where it's running over the rocks, you know. So if you're married to one of those deep silent types, that doesn't necessarily mean that you've got a big communication problem. One of the most beautiful ways of being together is to have communion, which is the root meaning of the word communication. And you can be comfortable together and you don't have to talk to be comfortable together. See, that doesn't always mean it's a communication problem. But the other size in which communication problems often come is knockdown, drag-out arguments. You can't talk for 5 minutes without getting angry. Now, another observation we can make about communication based upon this working definition is there is no such thing as not communicating. We're always communicating. The issue is what we're communicating and how we're communicating, but we're always communicating. Like the definition said, talk, gestures, or other means. Silent contempt is a form of communication, and silent contempt does mean you have a communication problem. If your spouse is treating you with silent contempt, that means you upset them, and so they're just giving you the deep freeze, silent contempt. One lady whose husband often did that, he was German and did that a lot. She used to say, you have to listen real close when he ain't talking to hear what he's saying. Because when he was silent, he was saying something, because he wasn't always silent. I had a guy call me one morning when I was a pastor of a small church and intimately involved with everybody, and he said, I think you better go see Ann. That was his wife. She's upset. I said, what makes you think she's upset? He said, well, the last thing to bounce off the car when I was pulling out was a golf trophy of mine. And I said, well, where were you going? He said, to play golf. And I said, do you think she might be sending you a message there by the fact that it was a golf trophy? He said, yeah, maybe so. But, you know, a slammed door, you wouldn't believe how many times I've seen a hole in the wall because a man put his fist through the wall. And it's nearly always the bedroom wall. Do you think that's making a statement? Is that communication? On the positive side, a smile, a hand on the shoulder, an embrace, tears, a sigh. Now, all of these things are communication. And see, there's no such thing as not communicating. Sometimes you're communicating through these gestures and other means, but that can be very eloquent communication. Francis Assisi, who's one of my heroes, said, in all things, preach Christ. Where absolutely necessary, use words. I think that's profound. Now, we can come to some conclusions, too, about communication based upon this definition. First, communication is not what's said, it's also what's heard. It may not be what you said, it's what they heard when you said that. Communication is not what's said, it can also be what's received. Communication is not what's said, it can also be what's felt, based upon gestures and things like that. Communication is not what's said, it's also what's conveyed, the total impression. Communication is not just what's said, it can also be what people want to hear. I've been fascinated by that one. I'm amazed at the ability of people to hear what they want to hear, no matter what the words were. There are also some insights we can gain into communication based upon this definition. I had a speech professor once in California. Came into a classroom, it was a speech class, and it was just chaos. It was just high level, high decibels, you know, of talking and carrying on. And he went up to his lectern, it was a table, and he slammed his open hand down on that table. It sounded like a shotgun blast. And he said, right as he slammed his hand on the table, I want absolute pandemonium. And the room got real quiet. Completely controlled the classroom. And then he explained to us what he had just demonstrated for us. 7% of communication is words. 55% of communication is the inflection upon the words. And 38% is the body language that accompanies the words that are spoken. He said, I want absolute pandemonium. That didn't control the classroom. That would have done the opposite if people had really understood what he said. But it was his inflection on the words when he said them. By the way he said them, he was saying, I want this class to come to order, see? And then slamming his open hand on the table, that got everybody's attention pretty good. That said something. And according to him, that's 38% of it. But the inflection on the words, he said, is 55% of the communication proposition. Think of this statement. A woman without her man is lost. You get the meaning? Now listen to it again. A woman without her man is lost. You get the meaning? Totally different meaning. And what changed the meaning? It's just the emphasis on the words. Well, all of that sort of thing is wrapped up in that profound little definition you get out of Webster's Dictionary. Communication is the giving and receiving of information, messages, and ideas by talk, gestures, or other means. The experts on communication tell us there are different levels of communication. There's the non-communication level, where you're using clichés that don't really share anything. Then there's factual information, comments about the weather, news events. This is sharing what you know. Then there's opinions and observations about things that really matter to you. This is sharing what you think. It's warming up now. Then there's emotions and feelings shared with intensity. This is sharing what you feel about things that are important to you. That's a higher level of communication. And then there are those intimate conversations where you talk about who you are, where you are, and where you think you should be. And this is sharing yourself. And this is a higher level of communication. In Christian marriage, since we're supposed to be other-centered, when you're sharing who you think your spouse is and what you think your spouse is and where you think your spouse is and who and what and where you think your spouse ought to be and where you'd like to see them be, now that's, I think, still a higher level of communication. Another thing we should say about communication up front is the value and the priority of communication. Frankly, I think all of us in our culture, and this includes Christian couples, do not highly value communication, marriage communication, these deeper levels especially, because we simply do not prioritize time, energy, and place to make sure that communication takes place. It takes time to communicate. But if you don't value communication, you won't give time to it. I once was challenging some couples about communication, and we had a discussion, and I was talking about making it a priority, and this woman's husband was an anesthesiologist, and she said, the only way I can ever get any communication with my husband is to get on a gurney and be rolled into the operating room, and when he goes to put that mask over my face, then I'll say, hey, Fred, this is me. Let's communicate. Because he absolutely allowed no time for communication, which means he didn't value it. Well, if you don't value communication, you're certainly not going to have communication. It takes time to communicate, it takes energy to communicate, and it takes courage to communicate. One of the reasons we don't communicate is we're just too tired. We say, I'm just too tired. It takes energy. I guess we sort of think it doesn't. It's not supposed to. And so we're not willing to expend energy for that. We expend it for everything else. From 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, we're expending energy to things that matter. But when we come home and it's time to communicate, we just don't value it enough. Paul Tournier, in his book, To Understand Each Other, in his first chapter says, to understand each other, we have to communicate. And then his second chapter is, to communicate takes courage. So I guess we should make this observation in introducing the subject. We must value communication enough to make time for it. We must value communication enough to expend energy for it. And we must value communication enough to have the courage to communicate. Now, years ago, when I used to do a lot of marriage counseling, so many people said in the first 5 minutes the problem was communication, that I, over a 10-year period, did this little research project. I asked couples, did you ever have good communication? Well, nearly always the answer was yes. Most people don't get married when they're not talking to each other, you know, so they had, yeah, there was a time we used to talk all night. In fact, when we first met, we had this day one time, and we talked till daylight. You know, they'd say things like that. Well, what about now? No, we don't ever talk. We don't have any communication. Well, then I gave them an assignment. If the communication problem was that they didn't talk anymore, I'd ask them, will you make a list for me of all the reasons why you stopped talking to your spouse? And be honest, you know, you don't have to show it to them, just show it to me. If they couldn't communicate without getting angry, I'd say, make a list for me of all the reasons why you lose it. when you try to communicate with your spouse. And over 10 years, I collected those lists and studied them. Here's a list of 24 circuit breakers, reasons why people stop talking or couldn't communicate without getting angry. They stopped talking because they discovered that their spouse was not listening. Typically, the woman would say, the baby found a thumb today, and she's all excited about all these things, and her husband's staring into space. He's a zombie. He's still at work, or maybe he picks a newspaper up or even turns on the boob tube. Just keep talking, you know, but he's going to watch the news while you tell him about the baby's thumb. Well, nobody wants the communication reduced to a monologue. See, not listening, that means something more serious. That means not interested. I'm not interested in you and the kid. I'm not doing stuff like that. I got my boss on my back. Haven't made my quota yet. I'm under the gun. Well, then she's not going to talk about the baby and all that stuff. He isn't interested. He's preoccupied. Or she is. He's not contributing anything to the communication. Don't you get tired of being the initiator all the time? They never contribute a word. They don't say anything. If you didn't ask a question, there wouldn't be any communication. Just silence, deep freeze. Not giving anything. See, it's supposed to be giving and receiving. Well, I'm always the giver. They never give anything. All they ever do is respond. It's like communication is a bridge. You build half of it. You come halfway, I come halfway. I build the whole bridge every time. They never build anything. They're showing no initiative to communicate. They're showing no enthusiasm for communication. They're forcing our communication into a monologue. They're treating me with silent contempt. They're pouting. They're hurt. They're mad. Again, because of the way the communication was received, perhaps, you know, they respond in this way. On the list, we had things like, my spouse is contentious. You know what a contentious person is? Solomon said a contentious woman and a dripping on a very rainy day are the same. Just drip, drip, drip. But what is a contentious woman? What's a contentious man? It means that you contend everything that comes up. If you realize they're bringing up a proposition like, I need a new washing machine, I'm going to contend it. I'm going to be against it. About time to trade cards, I'm against it. Always contending. It says in the scripture that a church officer, an elder, should not be contentious. Why is that? Because you don't want the board meetings to last till 3 o'clock in the morning. If he contends everything on the agenda, you're never going to get through the agenda, see? One time there was one of the silent types that she said, he just gets up from the dinner table and goes out for 3 or 4 hours. And then he comes in. He was sitting right there. I said, is that right? And he said, yep. I said, would you mind telling us why? And he said, well, if I tell him I'm going to a football game, I catch it. So I go to the football game, I come home, I catch it again. He said, that's twice. If I just get up and go and come home, I catch it, that's once. Yeah. He said once is better than twice, of course. You know, so he didn't ever tell her he was going to the football game thing. But the contentious person can be male or female. Then there's the opinionated person. Frequently wrong, but never in doubt. You know what I mean? Very strong opinions about everything. And who wants to debate? They say a bigot is a deaf orator. They can really hold forth, but when the other person's sharing, they're deaf. They don't ever hear the other person. They don't listen. I had a man one time, he had been in the Pacific with the Marines during the duration of World War II, and he said his wife was a Norrell sniper. I thought that was an interesting observation. He was out there in the Pacific where, you know, the Japanese would be up in the tree, strapped in the palm tree, and when the guy got vulnerable, they'd bang, a sniper. And he said she was a Norrell sniper. When he said something, it made him vulnerable, and then bang, he got it. You know, she sniped him. And then she responded, well, you're an oral assassin, she said, you know, because he would just take the paint off the wall. She didn't talk to him because she didn't want to get him upset. Well, we've had couples, especially who were getting over the problem of infidelity, which is an enormous challenge to a marriage, who had what the spouse considered a perverted curiosity, because at the root it was a suspicious nature. If they were 5 minutes late coming home, where were you? You know, that sort of thing. And that wreaks havoc with communication. Now, all of these circuit breakers I've just mentioned, 24 of them, I call the selfish factor in communication circuit breakers. Because all of these, if you analyze them at their roots, they're getting down to the fact that the person is selfish. They're not other-centered. They're self-centered. That's why they're not interested. That's why they're not listening. That's why they don't care about the other person or the other person's day. And of course, circuit breakers, you know, when they pop on your little electric panel, you can push them back, you know, and restore the circuit again. The thing that restores every one of these 24 circuit breakers is unselfishness or other-centeredness. That's the key. Another category I call the practical circuit breakers. These things wreak havoc with communication, but they're just practical things like the failure to make time for communication, television. They say a lot of couples have a communication problem, but they don't know it till the TV breaks down. If the TV breaks down, it's going to be a month. Then they discover, hey, we don't even talk. I mean, we don't even communicate. We're not skilled at this because the communication is one of those practical circuit breakers. I was called to a home one night. This family had just had a disastrous dinner hour. The father was an insurance agent. Most of his work and his pressure was at night. And he came in for sort of a pit stop, the dinner hour. And of course, he was all gussied up in his best suit and just immaculate, you know, ready for his appointments. Just about 5 minutes into the dinner, the wife says, you know, the bank called today and they're going to foreclose on this house if we don't come up with some money. And just then, the little baby, and had pablum all over its hands, I mean, grabbed his arm with both hands, you know, and started to cry. He looks at his beautiful suit with all this pablum on it. He just explodes. He almost turns the table over. He just loses it. And when the smoke cleared, what we discovered together was you violated a practical factor in communication. It's called time and place factor. There are many different kinds of communication in a home with children. And there must be a time and a place for these different kinds of communication. That was not the right time and the right place for what I call a board meeting. That's one kind of communication you have to have. I would say that that wife's timing was off. It was the wrong time, it was the wrong place. Now her argument is, there is no time, there is no place, because he didn't want to talk about this thing. Well, that's true too. And there has to be a time and a place. But violating that time and place factor, that's just a practical circuit breaker. There are such things as communication habits. Communication habits can be learned. They can be learned from your mother, from your father. And there is such a thing as a nagging wife. There's such a thing as a nagging husband. All of these things can be both ways. Communication habits, you can just get into a habit of nagging or being contentious or whatever. They say when you play golf, you have beginner's luck. They tell you how to hold your club and you do and start off pretty good, and then you develop these bad habits, and you get hooks and slices and all that. Well, in communication, it's almost like you have beginner's luck. You're infatuated, you're in love, you know, and you start off doing pretty well. But over a period of time, you develop these communication habits, and some of them are just habits, like being contentious or nagging or that sort of thing. Sometimes a practical communication circuit breaker is the failure to recognize the need that your spouse has for solitude. It's no reflection upon your intimacy if they still need some space. Khalil Gibran, who wrote the book The Prophet, had a little chapter on marriage, and he said, the two are one, but in some senses they're still two. And he said, strings of a harp, in order to make harmony, have to be spaced a certain distance apart. Large oak trees cannot grow in one another's shade. They have to be spaced a certain distance apart. Even though we're one, and it's an all-inclusive relationship, we shouldn't be threatened by the fact that our spouse needs space and we need space, because there are still senses in which we're still two. Well, these practical circuit breakers, I think, can be restored by just asking God for wisdom. One of my favorite verses is James 1:5, where it says, if any of you lack wisdom, ask God. The older I get, the more I pray that prayer. I find myself again and again and again just saying to God, I don't know what to do. I need wisdom. I haven't got it. And I'm amazed at how he responds and gives the wisdom that I need. There are also physical circuit breakers. I think we mustn't fail to consider the importance that physical factors can have in our communication. For instance, if your meaningful communication time is always at midnight and you both had an 18-hour day, that can impact your communication. You may not have the best kind of communication when you're both tired. And when one of you is sick, I knew a couple where she was very difficult to communicate with, and She had to have surgery on one of her ears, and they discovered her ear was eaten out with cancer, and it caused the emotional disorders that made her very difficult to be with. It was a physical factor in their communication. If your spouse is depressed, do you think that has an impact upon your communication? It may be that the husband doesn't want to listen, or the wife doesn't want to listen to an organ recital, organ by organ. You know, if one of you is sick, do you ever notice when you've had surgery how much you love to talk about it? I mean, it's called the martyr complex. You know, it's like it was a cold morning in October when they wheeled me into the operating room. You know, you like to start at the beginning, go through. But have you noticed that nobody's interested in that? I learned this a long time ago with my MS. People ask me how I'm doing, and I realize they don't really listen. I say, great, wonderful, marvelous, and tremendous, because nobody's going to listen when you start this organ recital. Well, there's this, there's, you know, nobody wants to hear that, see. So those could be physical factors in communication. And then there are psychological factors in communication. Now, I'm not an amateur armchair psychologist, even though I majored in this stuff 40 years ago. I resent people analyzing me. When I was a social worker, everybody was an armchair psychologist. If you had a cold and didn't show up, they'd say, you must have had a tough appointment today. You know, all of this, you know, paralysis of analysis. I really dislike that. But there is such a thing as mental illness. There is such a thing as psychological problems. And if you're married to someone with psychological problems, or you have psychological problems, don't kid yourself. That impacts on your communication. On these lists that turned up where they gave us the circuit breakers that broke down or snared the communication lines, a lot of these things turned up. Like if your spouse is depressed, now that's going to impact your communication. If they're angry, as I mentioned, I was angry the first few years that I was married, and believe me, that impacts your communication. If the person is projecting self-anger, this is a very real thing. It's in the Bible. This is what Cain did. When Cain was told by God that he was unacceptable and therefore his offering was unacceptable, he goes out and beats Abel to death. Now, why did he beat Abel to death? Abel didn't do anything to him. I believe Cain was angry with himself, and he projected his self-anger onto Abel. That's why when God came to him, he asked him, if you do what's right, will you not be acceptable? And if you don't do what's right and become acceptable, this thing's going to destroy you. A lot of people go through life beating Abels to death because they're projecting their own self-anger. Well, if you're married to someone who's doing that, believe me, that will impact your communication. If your spouse is insecure, unproven, unsure, defensive, threatened, it's very difficult to communicate with someone like that. If they're experiencing not only self-anger, but self-anger to the point of self-contempt, and self-contempt to the point of self-destruction, that's what an alcoholic is doing. Destroying himself or herself. And usually at the root of that, you'll find self-contempt, self-anger. And that's what leads them to self-destruct. I've seen people, and this intrigues me, it's like I've been studying the human family for a long time, and I'm intrigued about certain aspects of human nature. People who are doing this self-destruction thing, they will actually turn you away if you're trying to befriend them. And when they succeed in offending you to the point that you turn away from them, they just chalk up another one and say, there's another one that thinks I'm no good. See there? I'm really no good. I've known people to do that. I knew a lady who did that, and I vowed to God that I was going to love her anyway. And I did a great job for a couple of years, and I was the only friend she had in the world and all this. She said, you know, one summer I overstayed my vacation. I should have gone on vacation a month before I did. And after church, she and her husband invited us to have dinner, and we rode in their car up to the strip there at Virginia Beach, had dinner in a restaurant on the beach. And during the dinner, she attacked my best friends I had in the world. She started to cut them up one side and down the other, just shred them, and I lost it. And I just took her eye and said, you know there isn't a word of truth in that. And boy, it was an explosion. And we had to ride back to the church together, you know, looking out opposite windows. It was a disaster. And all she did was she just chalked up, see there, even he thinks I'm no good. It's amazing how people can do this. Well, if you're married to somebody who's doing all these things, they're paranoid, if they have these deep problems, if you see these psychological factors in them, then you've got to realize this. Until they get help with those problems, like we said at the beginning, if the persons both have problems, or one of the persons has problems, until that person gets help with those problems, the partnership's going to be sick. Partnership's got to be sick if one of the persons is sick. Now, if you're married to the person with the problems, then there are some scriptures that show you how to cope with living with a difficult person. I preached on this several times. I announced I was going to preach on how to live with a difficult person, and there was a big crowd, but everybody who came thought the other one was a difficult person, which is really very interesting. Foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they gender strifes, and the servant of the Lord must not strive, but be gentle, apt to teach, patient, in meekness instructing those that oppose themselves, if God peradventure will give them repentance to the acknowledging of the truth, and that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will. This is so profound. It's 2 Timothy 2, the last four verses. What this is saying is, if you're married to a difficult person, it's almost as if they have been taken captive by Satan. They're in Satan's dungeon, and you can't get them out. Only God can get them out. But here's what you can do. You can maintain the fruit of the Spirit. There are three fruit of the Spirit mentioned here: meekness, patience, and gentleness. If you will maintain this fruit of the Spirit, that will keep the door open for God and close it to the devil, and it will give you the opportunity to earn your hearing and then place before them the truth that can set them free. Now, when you reach that point, it's I can't, but he can, because it says, then God peradventure may give them, he may, the spirit of repentance, that they will acknowledge the truth. And if God gives them the spirit of repentance and they acknowledge the truth, then it says, they will be delivered out of the snare of the devil. It's very profound, too, in that it says their problem is they're opposing themselves. The word self means the individuality, the uniqueness of any given person that makes them distinct from every other person. They're opposing that. They're opposing God's will for their life. That's what it amounts to. That's how you live with someone who's got psychological problems, and it's messing up your communication and your relationship. Another simple version would be to simply pray the prayer Jesus prayed from the cross. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Just think, from the cross, Jesus prayed that for his enemies. Now, if Jesus prayed that for his enemies, do you think you could pray that for your spouse? If they're not responsible for what they're doing because they've got some real deep problems, well, then it would work miracles, I think, for you to pray, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. So you maintain the fruit of the Spirit and pray that God will be able to reach through to him. Well, there are a lot of scriptures in the Bible that tell us how to do that. Again, as we said before, you should always consider the possibility that you could be the one that is the difficult person, and therefore you should listen to the advice of Jesus in the first five chapters of Matthew 7, where he said, get that log out of your eye, and then you will see clearly to help your spouse get the speck out of their eye. Another verse along that line that Paul shared with Timothy, 1 Timothy 4:16, take heed to yourself and the scripture, continue in them, for in doing this you will save yourself and then those that hear you. You could apply that to marriage this way. If you get into the word and the word gets into you and you apply it to yourself, then you'll experience salvation. Then you can be a vehicle of salvation to that difficult person that you live with. Now, in conclusion, I'd like to say a few words about communication as a family. If you're a family with children, the communication factor is a lot bigger than just you and your spouse. I believe it's important for us to acknowledge the fact that in a family, for instance, my wife and I had three daughters and two sons. In a family like ours, there were some distinctions that needed to be made in communication patterns or combinations, and time had to be prioritized for all these different communication combinations. In our family, we found that we had probably about 30 different communication combinations, and they went like this: husband and wife, that's one combination. Then there's father and mother. The father and mother, that's the board meetings. We used to make the mistake of going out, it's our favorite restaurant, and while we're having a dinner we can't afford, we get into an argument about the children. And then we'd realize, but after the disaster, that we turned husband and wife time into board meeting time, father and mother time. See, that's two separate kinds of communication. You shouldn't mix them. But in our home, we also had parents and all the children together at one time, the family hearth. That's just about a lost cause today. Then there's the father with all the children. There were times when I felt like I should get all the children together and meet with them without their mother. And then I like to have a thing called gripe time, where they could gripe for 1 hour about anything that was going on that wouldn't be used against them. So I used to take my kids out and we'd have gripe time. I'll never forget one night in the Shoney's, we had this gripe time for an hour, and the kids really won a lot of concessions from me. I was pussycat. They loved to meet with me. And I gave in to a lot of things, and when we got up to leave, the people in the restaurant applauded, you know. They had been listening to this whole conversation and got a big kick out of it, especially the fact that the kids carried the night, you know. I think it's very, very important for the father to meet with the children, the mother to meet with all the children without the father. There was the father and the two sons, the mother and the two sons, the mother and the three daughters, the father and the three daughters. The father was son number one, the father was son number two. I believed our sons were very different. They always are. If you had 50 of them, they'd be different. And so I had father and son night with my sons individually. And then I used to love to have dates with my daughters, and they still remind me of the dates we had, one at a time. I'd go out on dates with the three daughters. And then I encouraged my wife, of course, to do the same things. And then all the siblings together. That's a wonderful thing when all five children get together without the parents. We call it the sounds of the siblings. We just love to hear that. Now, in my opinion, the most important of all these communication combinations is the first one, husband and wife. Now, that's debatable. If you have one of those situations like they have in values clarification where the mother were in a position where she could only save her husband or her child, which one would she save? I don't think I'd want to find out, you know. It'd be mother love's a very strong thing. But I have at least two reasons for saying that the strong relationship, the most important one, is husband and wife. Did you ever hear about the guy who said, how do you tell your wife that you've invited the boss and the whole company to come to your house for dinner? And the guy responds, just like porcupines embracing, very carefully. You explain it very carefully. See, well, how do porcupines embrace? Somebody wrote a poem about these two porcupines. It's real cold, it's at night, and they're married, and they want to get warm, they want to embrace, but every time they try to embrace, they get stuck. So how do porcupines embrace? Well, see, that's communication. Since it's a giving and receiving, it's not just the communication that's given, it's how it's received. When you communicate, it takes courage because sometimes the truth really sticks. So you have to make up your mind, you're going to just be separate or you're going to risk the pricks. In the normal cycle of life, they say, we can divide our life into three pieces, like three pieces of a pie. One third of our life we spend being nurtured by our parents, and then one third of our life we spend nurturing children with our spouse. And then there's still another third of our life that we spend when the nest is empty. Now, what that means is you're going to spend two-thirds of your life with your spouse. So the communication combination you really want to work on is that one, because that one's going to go on after the kids leave the house. I believe the husband and wife communication combination is the most important one, because all the other communication combinations are greatly damaged if the husband and wife communication breaks down. But I think it's also important to realize that this husband and wife combination is the important one, because you're going to spend two-thirds of your life with that spouse in the normal cycle of life. A lot of people make the mistake, I'm sorry to say, while the children are being nurtured, they make the mistake of putting the children first. The operative word in so much of marriage is mutual. And as long as things are mutual, you can get away with a lot. Mutually, we've always put the children first. She's always said, if you only have a certain amount of time, give it to them. And, you know, if you've only got a certain amount of energy, I never mind her giving it to them. We mutually agree on that. But this can be very dangerous, because while the children are being nurtured, if you neglect your relationship, when that nest empties, you look at each other and you haven't got a relationship. And you realize, we haven't got a marriage. You'd be amazed at this data of, you know, marriages that break up at that point when the nest is empty, because we didn't work on it. All those years, we just put the kids first. You know, I've known more women who have said, I'm burned out, used up, and broken down. And they're gone, and they're not looking back. Now what do I do? My husband, man, we don't have any relationship. So, you know, now what? Well, this is why it's very, very important to work on your marriage. And as we said at the starting gate, communication is what gives you the tools to work at your marriage. So that's why you have to really focus communication, so we can end on the upbeat. It's very tough to strengthen some of these links that make us one. If you're incompatible, if one of you has an IQ of 140 and one has an IQ of 85, that isn't going to change. You talk a lot about acceptance. You just have to accept a lot of things, you know. But communication is something you can do something about if you really want to. And if you work at your communication, then you gain the tools to work at the whole relationship.
Oh, that's great. Just a little inflection. Let's do a test. When you say, I love you, does it come out sounding like, I love you, or, I love you? Or is it, I love you? See, your tone of voice and inflection says it all. That's a practical help Dick gave us today, isn't it?